Gifted Talks Fundraising offers you a seat at the table for a relaxed chat about what it takes to build successful giving programs. Marshalling decades of practical hands-on experience, the Gifted Directors provide helpful advice and top tips for achieving your fundraising goals.
Hey guys, welcome back to Leamington Spa in 1 Mill Street, our home away from home. It's good to see you all again, and thanks for coming personally to see you in 3D for this podcast today. We're going to be talking about making AI work for fundraising without losing the human touch. And we have all four gifted directors here with us, including the latest addition to the team, Connor Beeson. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Chris, brilliant. Got you off the golf course. Yeah. And Amy, thanks for traveling. It's been nice to see you again. Thank you for coming down. Okay, so this is building on that whole question around using technology and where we now stand in, what dare I say, 2026. I feel so old, I still actually think sometimes like I'm in the last century, let alone this one. But making AI work for fundraising is a bit of a conundrum, because we know it is that human chemistry that really causes people to respond positively to the vision and the, if you like, the case for support that our charities are crafting and building. There's a lot of noise around this at the moment, Connor. So what are you hearing? Where's AI working? What's going on out there?
So, so this is a problem that I get probably spoken to about every single day for the last few months now, is that people say, we're thinking of doing AI. How do we do AI? And the question itself doesn't make sense.
Okay.
Right? So it is the equivalent, because it is could be everything or anything. Okay. It's sort of like saying, how do we do charity? It's how do you possibly answer that question?
Okay.
So the point is, on how people are using AI in a really good way at the minute, is they're laser focusing on the things that are draining their resources in the things that AI is really good for, which is efficiency type work, like research analytics, that kind of work. That's where it makes sense. Huge value.
So is it really, Chris, about understanding what you're doing at the moment, being really clear where your time is being spent, so that you can then see where there might be efficiencies and where you can use some of these new tools?
Yeah, because look, let's get one thing absolutely straight. AI is not going to fundraise for you.
Okay, it's not a magic wand.
It's not a magic wand. It isn't what so many of our clients seem to want, that silver bullet that's going to unlock everything.
Yeah.
AI is not that. But what AI is a magnificently effective tool if you get it right. Mm. And efficiency of research, efficiency of processes, all of that contributes to a successful fundraising department. Mm. But, and there is a big but to all of this, it cannot operate in isolation. You can't just press a button and magically raise millions of pounds.
I mean, I'm fairly freaked me out, some of this stuff, you know, the digital generated imagery of, you know, Brad Pitt in a fight. Who was it with? I'm trying to remember which other actor. But it was that. It looked real. It looked completely real. And all the spoofing you see on social media, and it makes you sort of, with all the scam stuff that's going on, it makes me very wary of some of this technology and authenticity.
I question every reel I've seen now. Yeah. I'm like, is that real?
Yeah.
So is that what we want in fundraising? I mean, where are you, as a tool, where are you thinking you might apply it, and you'd be really wary of applying it, Amy? How are you seeing AI working for us today?
I think it's a fantastic research tool nowadays, definitely. Where I push back and where I feel uncomfortable is when people are using it too much for writing.
Yeah.
You know, as a company, we have a specific tone of voice. As a charity, you will have a tone of voice that you write in that, you know, really effectively tells your story. And I don't think a lot of AI is at that stage yet. You know, you can tell when somebody has drafted an email to you and it was written by ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or whoever, because it just doesn't sound the same. Yeah. So that's where my nervousness is at the minute. But then I see the real benefit on the other side of it as well.
I stopped reading an autobiography, in inverted commas, because about two chapters in, I thought, this is AI written.
Okay.
I don't know what it is.
But there was something about the way it was written.
Yeah.
And I just thought, no, this is an AI generated book.
But look, there are some real advantages here. I can already think of a couple. Okay. But you go, come on, Connor. Where are the advantages of using AI?
Yeah. I think this is really important. So on that point around the trustworthiness and things like that, I actually don't think it's going to be that long before a piece of copy can be adapted more or less more or less convincingly anyway, if you just want your template sort of stuff, into tone of voice. There's already things that can somewhat do that. What I think is the wider problem is that I think very, very clear, this is where I'm using my various psychology degrees and things now, because I think people will adapt like a sixth sense to this stuff, as you already are.
Yeah.
In the same way that if you're scrolling through any social media, without even, you get an ad every three posts or whatever it is, you don't even see that ad. You already instinctively, subconsciously skip past it, because something about it is a sixth sense. Now, that will be somewhat different with AI as they evolve over time. They'll just be hyper-realistic. But I think the important thing for charities to look at with the long-term effect of that is to look at what the symptom of that being is, which we already talked about here, which is if people will just not have a clue what to trust, the symptom of that, particularly like the new generation of people over the next 10 years and things like that, will suddenly just be very untrustworthy over things online, quite likely to a certain degree.
Yeah.
So when that comes to charitable giving, I've got quite a strong feeling that human interaction, particularly things like community fundraising and memory of fundraising, are going to be like so much more important in terms of the overall mix of fundraising, but because they are, you can't fake it. That is purely in person, and I think people will crave it more because they'll only have this.
Interesting though, that I just said I don't know how I knew it was AI, but I did. Yeah. And like you say, it's almost like a sixth sense.
But the thing
it?
Is, you either know because you have that sixth sense, or you think that because you're just you're so conscious of it, and it's the untrustworthiness. And I think the untrustworthiness will grow over time, even as the things get better. By the nature,
I have to say though, even simple Apple AI, you know, I use that to proofread for me my email before I, because I'm often just getting an email out, and I think, hang on, I better just. So I just hit the proofreader and it goes it through and it fixes my grammar. And yeah, I'm confident.
That's an angry email, Andrew, and it says, phrase this more politely for me.
It does add the odd adjective sometimes, but equally it can make it more concise if necessary.
I just thought it was translation from Australian to English, quite frankly.
Well, that too. There is, though, too. I mean, we do a lot of interviews and one-on-one conversations, and it's brilliant to be really present in the interview instead of always scratching away at notes and getting key points down. So using the note-taking feature, for example, in some of these online is really, really helpful and provides, I think, quite useful summaries at the end. It's not the front of house stuff. I'm not sending it to anybody, but for my own use, it means I can be very present in the meeting.
I think that's the point, isn't it? That AI is a wonderful tool to help us do our jobs properly.
Yeah.
You know, not miss what somebody may have said in an interview. Identify things we may not have thought of before. It's great, you know, when you're starting an engagement, an assignment, just to type it in and just see what it comes up with as a sort of way just to get your head in the game a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, it's only the platform that you can only build on with human knowledge, experience, genuine understanding. And coming back to the point about the fake AI stuff that we now see everywhere, you do spot it.
So,
and equally, you spot it in fundraising terms. You try to shortcut the system by using AI, it's not going to work.
No. So, Connie, what are the risks? What are the things, you know, that we've really got to be... What are you worried about when you see AI being taken up in fundraising teams or with our clients at the moment?
Yeah, so it's it being adopted wrong is, I keep arguing that the risk of doing that wrong is far worse than any benefit you get from it. And this is coming from people that I speak to like very, very regularly on a several times weekly basis, who are like senior developers, they've worked with the government, all that kind of stuff. They know AI inside it, that's the whole career. Those are the people you want to look at. And they're all saying the same things. They go, if you mess it up, I'm waiting for the day.
Give us an example then of a mess up.
Go on.
Well, theoretically, if you've got all your file system integrated onto your computers that your charity or school works
with. Not unusual.
Really easily, people could install something like Claw Code or Cowork and the ChatGPT equivalents and things like that, and it has effectively untethered access to the internet and your system and files. If you don't set the restrictions up and what we call guardrails up properly, it could quite literally remove your entire, all your records, all your work, your CRM. The chaotic nature of it is that it will do the thing it's told to do and fill in the gaps if it's not told how to fill in the gaps.
Oh, I see. So it goes into the spaces that are...
It could do. Yeah, absolutely. I'm waiting for the day where, not positively, but it will happen, where we see the first charity or school is in the press because they're, you know, they accidentally sent, you know, stuff that they definitely should have by accident to their whole CRM because they tried to use automations and they didn't do the things right.
I mean,
or they built entire systems where it just broke their entire CRM, which meant that donor names were attached to the wrong information because it mixed the...
It just got to start.
There's a really big thing at the minute where if you try to get AI to work with like large data sets, like a CRM could be an example of that. With when you have empty fields... It's quite often is the case if you don't build the loads of different sort of guidelines and rules in with this, is it will start to try to fill that gap because it's trying to work out what is there and what should be there.
Okay.
Because it's trying to do an analysis piece of work, so it goes, oh, and then it will start assuming. That's where you get things called where they, if you've heard the phrase, like where they hallucinate.
Yeah.
What that. A dumbed down version, what that
AI hallucinations.
Yeah, it's actually quite a good way of describing it. It's not just fear mongering.
And it tries to put stuff in that field because it hallucinates that that's what should be in there.
The hallucination thing is a very dumbed down way of describing this, is that when you give it a task that's too big without any set rules, it's like if I threw at you a piece of work to do and it was just like a billion numbers and spreadsheets and it was all, none of it aligned, nothing made sense, and you were like, well, that doesn't align to that cleanly, it's too much data, and it just tries to just infer at that point.
Okay.
It needs clear deterministic.
It's like we do in our mind with schema. It tries to take
that's
shortcuts.
That's exactly.
So it's the same way that we get to process information in the human brain.
I think the real worry at the minute is people see these things as almost godlike, fully intuitive creatures that understand everything because they almost gaslight you into believing that.
So these guide rails, did you call them?
Guardrails.
Guardrails are really, really important. So instead of having artificial intelligence, it could be the idiot in the room, could be the AI, if we're not careful, if we don't have good guardrails down.
Well, it will either...
could really destroy an awful lot of relationships.
It will either do what it's told.
Yeah.
Which may be too vague and it will interpret and it won't know. Or it will kind of start doing things without any rules attached to it.
Oh, blimey.
And that's when it then starts to come up with information that isn't accurate.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you just go with that because AI has told you, that's when you run into mistakes.
Yeah.
So in fundraising terms, you know, we talk a lot about the importance of a great case for support. You put something, if you just let AI write your case for support, it's probably going to be 90% brilliant, but 10% of it might be fundamentally wrong.
But I think that's the great benefit of it, though, isn't it? You know, you can search something really quickly.
Absolutely.
It gives you those key headlines, and instead of spending hours searching various pages on an internet browser, you can then just really drill down and fact check.
Yeah. And, but you then need to do, this is the human bit, got to do the fact check.
So if we're looking, the grant funder, you know, person in your team, in your charity ABC, you know, has got a fabulous AI tool. Off we go. Pours in the list of the various charitable trusts and foundations, pours in the case for support, presses go and produces what, you know, tens of thousands of applications go out the door. That's happening? Is that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's happening right now. And actually, this is something that I very passionately advocate against doing,
of course,
for two reasons. First of all, it's just not effective from a trust perspective, because I think with trust and foundations, people just often forget that you're not sending an application to an organization, you're sending it to a bunch of people around a room.
Yeah.
And I think, again, when we go back to like what are the symptoms of what people are going to, over the next sort of, let's say, 10 years, you know, invite only is going to continue to rise, absolutely, because of things like that.
Of course.
It's never been easier to just churn out automatically.
Less general open charitable trust.
100%.
It's more and more by invitation only. But there may be some flexibility in the way they deal with you then. Do you think that might be a benefit if you're invite only? There'll be a partnership sort of arrangement to work with you?
I'm hope it will shift towards those invite only funders will at least not be limited to just the charities that they know, which disproportionately puts out all the small charities anyway, because they're less connected by nature.
True.
They'll have other ways of finding them and researching them.
Yep.
But what I think is the interesting thing around with AI is that you forget that these are people that are reading applications. And if we look at a world where you go, on paper, if you look at trust and foundations, it would technically just be better for everyone if no human wrote an application and no human assessed the impact of it. And then you just use a system where one agent speaks to another agent, which is what people are discussing right now.
Yeah.
And they just quantitatively do some kind of algorithm and work out these are the ones that will fund. The problem with that is not only is that, you know, kind of potentially bad for some reasons, you could argue it's beneficial. But why would you, as a trustee of a grant maker, you would get nothing really from that.
No.
Why would you even want to be a trustee of a grant maker if you don't even, you're not even feeling anything from it?
Maybe the whole thing is very much moving into the world of the Matrix.
No.
And we've got AI bots reading AI applications.
Well, that is exactly where it's heading. It's already happened
but
now.
Blimey.
But I think it's actually really good in a lot of ways to that, efficiency and everything. But the response to that is people saying, well, yeah, as it could be good if the funders did that. But in practice, like, why would they? Because they're not going to get really any of the benefit from reading those applications or at least some information.
Well, that
information,
one thing
then
that really resonates with you when you read something on a personal basis, they're not going to get, are they?
Yeah. We sent some applications recently for an animal rescue centre, and there were a few of them were quite general information that I had online. I put a picture of one of the dogs, it was like the cutest picture ever, at the top of it. I very rarely will put pictures on an application, but I knew that I'd found out that those trustees had a particular interest in dogs, so I put a picture of a dog on there, and it looked very amateur by design. That was the point of it, is that this is a very real photo. They came back straight away, it was like a 20 grand grant.
There you go.
It wasn't an AI dog. It was a real dog.
It was a real dog.
Real circumstances.
It's clearly not an AI assessment of that your application.
Okay. Do you think more funders will to block kind of the blanket continuous applications? Do you think more of them will start to put expression of interest in first or anything like that?
I hope so. I think the best model, rather than going purely invite only or doing or things like that, is to do an initial, extremely simple, short, you know, doesn't take a lot of time to put your stuff in assessment with very, very clear eligibility.
Yeah.
Those are the two things which put out the charities the most, and those are actually the things that will probably help the grant makers the most if they still want to do applications.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of downsides to invite only, again, which disproportionately puts out smaller charities anyway, so I tend not to try and do that or advocate for that even. Sorry, but
if you think about it logically, you know, a grant maker publishes its criteria and what it's going to assess a project. The big ones do. If five charities doing the same thing say to AI, write me a proposal against these objectives,
you're going to get the
recipients, the grant maker is going to get five exactly the same applications. A, how can they decide? But what they're now doing, quite rightly, is recognising them and going, no. We tendered for a piece of work which we didn't get in Europe. And on the tender brief, it said, we accept that AI will be used as part of this engagement, but we do not want AI-generated results. We expect a consultant to give us the results based on the advice based on experience. Mm. So even organisations now are starting to get ahead of the game and just except that AI is here, it's not going anywhere, but it's got to be used properly, and human information, human experience is more important.
So it is very much then around AI being a tool that you then pick up and use in your day as a professional fundraiser. And in which case, and there's certain tools, you know, if you choose a hammer as opposed to a screwdriver, you'll get a very different effect, literally, on a piece of wood or any project you're working on. AI in a similar way. So how do you, I'm going to go to you, how would you see AI being well used by a fundraiser today, given the constrictions of, you know, the status of the technology as it stands?
Yeah, so I would do things like you would do with, say, like a CRM audit, if you're like assessing, you know, different, maybe if you want to use a different platform or whatever it is, in the same way that rather than going, let's use AI and then nobody uses it because they don't even know where to start, you first start looking in your sort of fundraising team, what are the efficiency savings, first of all, that you can make? Are there like admin research, analytics, that kind of
sort
work?
Process work.
Yeah. What are those things and how much time are they taking up?
Yeah.
Then the stage after that, which I would strongly recommend, would be to work with an actual developer.
Yeah.
Not what we would call a vibe coder, who can sound extremely convincing. What is a vibe coder?
It is somebody
who is effectively developing stuff because they know how to use some AI tools, but they're not developers.
Right.
So snake oil salesman, in a sense.
Okay.
Right. You can still do things, but if you're looking at entire charity-wide things, that's where the risk comes in. Because it's still coding. It's still the tiniest little bug in the system can go wrong.
Mm.
So work with what you call CTOs or developers, and then, you know, have initial conversations, say these are the things that we're looking to do organizational wide that could save us a lot of time. could there be something we could do with that? If so, how? And then guide you through that, and then you can build things.
Okay. And this doesn't need to be a hugely expensive piece to get a CTO. And it's a whole new world for me to come in, or is this? Am I
it
talking?
It entirely depend on
depends
what the
on the brief is. Yeah.
Entirely okay. dependent. There's some okay. super super simple things that
yeah.
you got. You kind of have a mix of like your day to day stuff, like some research and
yeah.
just generally. You could, frankly, you could have a good training session by someone who knows enough and how to do much better accurate research so that you know it's not going to be fake and all the rest of it. You could yeah. do that. We could do that.
Sure.
Or you have the more infrastructure process level stuff, which yeah. is where those risks get.
And just
come into.
But a friend of mine works for a very well-known major international consultancy, management consultancy, who said that we're going to do, the board of directors clearly met and said, we're going to do AI. So they bought licenses for their 300,000 consultants around the world, whatever that costs, it must have been hundreds of millions of pounds later. Mm. And then 6 months in, they thought, well, why is it, where's the productivity gain? What's happening here? And they surveyed their workforce to find that less than 2% actually were using the AI mm. resource of it, because they didn't know really what it could do, or in particular, as you were saying, how to, where that tool can be best applied to help them yeah. get more efficiencies. Yeah.
I think there's a really good DIY analogy which the developers that I know use themselves,
yeah.
which is if you're going to do, I don't know, a home extension on your house, for example, you either pay someone who's experienced in that trade and knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, which is a sensible option. You can pay someone who's far cheaper, who doesn't have that, but the chances are it's not going to last. It's going to get knocked down, and then it will yeah. cost you three times as much to fix it all. yeah.
You can try and do it yourself.
And then you go to B&Q, spend 40 quid and go, I've just saved 30 grand here. Yeah, and then you knock down everything and you've got to pay for the team to fix it.
And it probably takes you about five times as long.
Yeah.
Because you suddenly realize you've got lots of other things to do.
I love drilling. Sorry.
Right, yeah. But do the drilling for putting up shelves. Yeah, is another good analogy. You know, there are certain the day-to-day things that can be taught. You can be taught how to do them in the day and you can do them really well. But the DIY analogy works really, really well. Yeah, because it just the risk of these things is so clear.
They talk about it being a learning curve, the costs of going up the learning curve. Okay, you might eventually understand how to do this, but you will have to pay with time and mistakes and so on to get to the same point as going out there and buying someone who's already at the top of that learning curve and knows exactly
how to do it. But without blowing our own trumpets, that's why people like us exist for. That's what consulting is about.
Very true.
We have, we as an organisation over the last 10 years have worked with more than 180 different clients. We understand, and they're all different from different sectors. The fact is we use all the experience that we gain as a team across those 180 clients, and we put that into our next assignment.
Mm. Mm.
And now what we're able to do is add the extra technology that we can then use and interpret to give our clients even better advice.
And Amy, surely this is about steps on a journey rather than trying to adopt a very complex sort of solution that can be quite expensive to implement when you've got scarce resources. Surely it's about saying there are AI tools available now built into so much of the software we buy. How can we use them to better effect, to plan our day, to book our diaries, to proof check? Isn't it really just about basic?
You're making
stuff?
Me laugh because you know what a kind of control freak I am about my diary and booking systems.
I know.
But yes.
But why not? It's your life. I mean, you're
tired.
There's
so many simple
back.
Things, isn't there, that we can use just to make life that bit easier
yeah.
on a day-to-day basis. And not just in our actual fundraising, but in the admin that we all have to do around going to work and, like you say, booking appointments and what have you, using online video platforms and the note-taking and what have you.
Are we actually going to end up with it? Can I, when I'm on the tube or going somewhere, will there be an assistant sometime that says, get me a dental appointment, book my car in for a service?
That's a PA, Andrew.
That's called
I used to have them. We don't do that anymore.
What that's called, it's called the agentic web, which is Ooh. Where things are, which is very matrixy.
So it does exist.
It's literally got the word age in it. That is where the future is inevitably going to go.
That's what
outside
going.
Of charity.
Okay.
Where to the point that we probably won't really have phones anymore to an extent. I mean, the Meta glasses type thing is one way of doing that, even though it's
How
not adopted.
Cool is that?
We'll just get to the point where we're effectively just talking to a chatbot, and it will go, if you go, I want to book a holiday to Spain, and it will do the entire thing for you because it will know everything you want. It'll do all the matching. It will then speak. The agents will then speak to the other agents to get the best deals online. It will all be relatively very futuristic, but we're really there. the agentic web is something that will start to restrict the use of, you know, how many platforms and systems do we all use at the various schools.
Yeah,
and,
true.
You know, charities that we work with, they'll eventually be shrunk down into just one automated thing. So you open your laptop and it'll all just be within the one thing, which is a massive efficiency in itself.
Do you know,
as much as
that's a lovely sort of futuristic dream. Well, lovely at one level, scary at a lot of other levels.
That's more scary than lovely to me.
But have you noticed, you know, all these different messaging platforms that we get, you know, and you get your voicemail, you get text, you get WhatsApp, you get, Facebook Messenger, you get, you know, LinkedIn, all this stuff. I just said, can we just have it all in one? We still don't have one messaging platform, right? And just go, right, I've got six messages, and one happens to be on LinkedIn, another... Just something as simple as that would change my life.
Because they've all got a different purpose, though, haven't they?
I think Siri...
They still want to talk to me.
If you think of Siri as like the closest working example to that right now, technically you can just speak to Siri hands-free in the car and you can open Spotify and play a song for you, or it can WhatsApp someone
for
you.
It doesn't understand Australian, and it always wants...
Well, you can't blame him for that, can you?
And it's so polite when I swear at it. I can't...
Ultimately, you know, you've got Alexa, haven't you? You've got these sorts of domestic tools that you can talk to and will respond. Now, the trouble with that, of course, is they'll suddenly kick off of their own accord because they've heard you say something somewhere relevant.
Yeah. No, I don't trust any of them. I think they're listening to me.
There is a huge part of me, age 65, that thinks, thank God I'm the age I am, because I'm not sure I necessarily want to live in a world in 30 years' time.
Oh, Chris.
When everything's Chris. Done for it. Although, by the time I'm 95, I might think it's bloody great.
Yeah. You'll be grateful.
If we take it back to charities and schools for a second. this is much further down the line thinking, by the way. There's a huge, like, in the next 5 to 10 year period of, like, learning, upskilling, infrastructure building things, right? But charities and schools will be able to get to the point where they could quite conversationally to their Teams chat environment and things like that say, can you tell me who the top 20 donors are on our CRM who... and you tell it the rankings that you want, because they've got, like, we did a well screen, I want those, but I want them only the ones that have had some kind of interest where they opened up these types of comms from us in the past. Rather than generating loads of reports and maybe speaking to different teams and things like that, you could just do it.
Yeah.
And you can give you the information that you want to work a lot more efficiently. But again, it's just it comes back to efficiency. And what do you do with that? You save time and you've got better results to work with. Now you've got to actually
make sure your data's in shape, right?
Is so important, and your policies are right where we started. Guys, some final thoughts on this one. Chris,
brilliant tool, but humans have to be in charge of it. Because if they're not, in fundraising terms, you're going to make mistakes. And we all know in fundraising, if you make mistakes, those mistakes can be fatal.
Very true. Amy?
Yeah, agreed. I'm horrified. No, I agree. Let's use it as a tool to make our lives more efficient and enable us to do the personal face-to-face fundraising.
Connie, you were quite emphatic there about not losing that human touch. What's your final thoughts on this and how we're going with AI?
Yeah, well, I think because as we've talked about in this podcast, people, particularly when we're working within fundraising, because we have to categorize things and put them in their boxes and like different types of teams, major donors, corporate, etc. It's actually quite easy to forget that. How do you, as a person in your personal life, when you get a letter drop through your door, what is the reason that you've chosen to drop it, put it in the bin, or engage with it? We sometimes forget that is a almost entirely purely emotional response, and that is what we need to go back to. But I would strongly recommend every charity and school looks at the time efficiencies, particularly with analysis and research and things like that, to make massive savings, to make that the emotional storytelling side a lot better. And that's
put the picture of the cute dog in at the top.
Put the picture of the cute dog in.
Yeah. Guys, thank you very much again. I think this is a subject we're going to be coming back to and developing in future podcasts. Brilliant to see you again at 1 Mill Street. Safe journeys home. All the best. Thanks for pulling up a chair and joining our conversation today. Please share any comments or even pose some questions for future episodes by emailing us at inquiries@giftedphilanthropy.com.